This is a segment from the Annex Sociology Podcast. For more information, visit us on the web at theannexpodcast.com. Small disclaimer, we lost Gabriel halfway through that conversation.
Yeah, I just want to distance myself from whatever socialist nonsense these guys were ranting about.
All right. What's next on this slate, Leslie?
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, I've been following this story for a few weeks now. It's a couple of weeks. So, yeah. So the New York Times had an article, I want to say it was on the front page, discussing the plight of, this generation of Caribbean migrants to the UK. People who migrated to the UK from like around like 1948 to around 1971. And during this time, they're called the Windrush generation because of the ship that, you know, that took them from their islands to the UK, primarily, you know, to London. And I guess since 2012, when Theresa May, who is now the prime minister, but at the time when she was home secretary and decided to usher in these very, very tough immigration laws, making it really, really hard for people to get jobs if they didn't have particular documents, I think one of the unintended consequences, although quite a few Black Britons are saying that maybe it wasn't so unintended, was that these people who migrated to the UK during this point in time, when they were UK citizens because, you know, they were part of the British Empire, you know, they were from the colonies, and they were actually encouraged to come to the UK and England in particular, help rebuild after World War II. And basically since 2012, it seems that people from, you know, who came from the colonies, you know, up until 1971, they're having a very, very difficult time working, you know, getting access to healthcare, among other things. And actually, some are actually being subject to deportation. And this all came to a head, earlier this month, when leaders of former British colonies, you know, came to London for a Commonwealth meeting. And I guess they called Theresa May on it, and she had to apologize, and she made a pledge to actually try and right the wrongs. And so that, in a nutshell, is the story. And I just thought it was a very interesting story, especially given our conversation with Gene Beeman last week.
It reminds me of DACA, kind of, right? Is it's somebody's in a gray zone, and I guess what happened? They weren't officially citizens, but they were sort of de facto treated like citizens for years.
Yeah, well, I mean, because number one, they were encouraged to come to the UK, right? I mean, and they were British dependencies at the time. Like many of these island nations were not island nations yet; they weren't independent, right? So they were still part of the British Crown. So you would think that would mean that you were de facto citizens, right? But I guess not.
That actually strikes me as knowing nothing about British immigration law. although I'll pretend to be an expert, you know, that actually strikes me as a stronger legal claim than the DACA recipients who...
Stronger.
Because the DACA recipients, you know, may have some moral claim or some sympathetic claim, but, you know, prior to Obama's executive order, they had no legal claim whatsoever. So, whereas, you know, there was actually some ambiguity. There was a policy of benign neglect for decades, which is what created the situation. But, you know, in theory, the law never allowed any claim whatsoever. But, you know, you're saying that, you know, prior to, you know, the decolonization, well, no, but even before that, right, prior to decolonization, you know, So when did most of the Caribbean colonies become legally autonomous from Britain? The 60s?
Some of the bigger ones in the 60s, and then many of the smaller ones then followed suit in the 70s.
Okay, so if the period of immigration was all mostly in the 50s and 60s, right, then like you're saying, these people mm-hmm. would have migrated mm-hmm. at a time when they were, members of the same polity. And then this, yes. Period of, Commonwealth, even though, allied nations, but not strictly speaking citizens of the same polity until very recently. So, which, like you're saying, it's actually a stronger claim.
Yeah. It is. So it seems to me like it's kind of a bait and switch, right? Although, I think yet again, and maybe it's, kind of my habit, the bad habit that people tell me I have of actually giving people the benefit of the doubt all the time. Mm-hmm. And that perhaps, in 2012, when this happened, it actually was, this had more to do with sort of the large number of Eastern Europeans coming, not just Eastern Europeans, but like people, no, not Eastern Europeans, because they would have been part of the EU, except for the ones who aren't part of the EU. But there were migrants coming from other parts of the world at that point in time in large numbers. And I think that that's what the Home Office was responding to. And they weren't necessarily thinking about these, these Caribbean migrants who'd been in the country for decades, right? Mm-hmm. And at the time of their migrating, didn't need papers because they were like, oh, well, you're from Jamaica, you're kind of one of us, except not one of us. And so this policy that was intended to curb undocumented migrants in the UK from getting certain benefits, from getting housing, and from having jobs, it then unintentionally affected this.
Well, that's
other
a group. Common thing, particularly in Europe, where you'll see a policy that is intended to basically, do something, often of symbolic importance to a disfavored group, but they write the policy more generally, and then it ends up affecting other groups. So there's been a lot of policies in Europe that have basically been designed to, with the intent of reducing the visible Muslim minority. But the policies are written facially neutral and they end up affecting Jews too. Mm. So, right. You could like them on their own terms or not. That's kind of the point. I'm just saying that it's similar in that a group that is a policy that is intended either to solve a problem with some group or just to harass some group ends up having a problem, creating issues with other groups. So France has ratcheted up its laïcité laws, which everybody knows are basically, in practice, laïcité just means militant secularism, and they've had those laws since the revolution, but they've been ratcheting them up lately. Everybody knows that they did this in order to keep people from wearing hijabs in public, but they wrote them in a facially neutral fashion so that they end up limiting the expression of Orthodox Jews. Many European countries have passed laws against ritual slaughter, which are intended to basically harass halal butchers, but end up also harassing kosher butchers. So you see that same type of thing where there could be a longstanding and more or less favored minority, and then there's a new disfavored minority, and people write a law to, harass and or solve an actual problem with a new disfavored minority that ends up affecting the old favored minority, incidentally.
Yeah, and it seems to me another thing that this has in common with some of the things that we've been seeing, at least here in the United States, is that when Theresa May was called on it, she blamed the Labour Party, yeah. And then they dug, and then they did a little bit of digging, and they were like, "Oh, actually, this was a policy that was written when you were Home Secretary." She was like, "Okay, my bad."
Yeah,
passing the buck.
You know what? I'm thinking about is sort of the evolution of the institution of citizenship in England, in particular, maybe more globally, because didn't the British have this idea that if you went off to fight with ISIS, that they would revoke your citizenship? And I remember that discussion or that policy existing a few years ago, and to my mind, that was sort of a a de-sanctifying of the institution, right? It made it, rather than something that once it was given to you, it was yours forever. It became sort of like a privilege, citizenship. And I wonder if this is another unintended consequence of our war on terror.
Well, I mean, it reveals the fluidity of immigration and citizenship rights sort of over time, which is that they can change on a dime, relative to you know, political decision making is a little frightening right now. Mostly because, I mean, if you think about the refugee crisis going on around the world and immigrant flows, immigrants searching for places to live, these issues aren't going away. I mean, this article that Leslie was talking about is just fascinating. I mean, the case in point they bring up is this guy who has been in the UK for 50 years. And you know, and now they're saying, no, you don't belong here anymore. And I don't know. I mean, even, you know, Mexican, sort of the extent to which documentation is necessary for migration, even in and out of the U.S. for migrant workers, ebbs and flows over time. How restrictive it is a sort of a political decision. And it has to be frightening for these populations.
Yeah, we're in a period where everybody's sort of trying to expunge the others from their society. Like the interesting thing in that story was that one of the people had a passport that said they're a British subject and a citizen of the colonies.
Yeah,
like, nope, sorry.
Well, I do think it's interesting, and somebody brought up a little bit ago that this seems to have possibly been in reaction to the massive increase in intra-EU immigration over the last 10, 20 years, which has kind of led to a backlash against migration in the UK, as in many advanced democracies. Mm-hmm. You know, that seems to have been tied up with the policies of the politics of Brexit, where there was a notion that it wouldn't necessarily reduce immigration overall. It would just redirect it from intra-EU migration to intra-Commonwealth migration. But this doesn't seem to follow that theoretical payoff of Brexit.
For more, visit us on the web, theannexpodcast.com.